Accession number 12707, Captain Frank Brewis, Reel 9.
Captain H.C.F. Brewis, Reel 9. When a man was found guilty by court-martial and sentenced to Captain Brewis, what kind of punishments could he expect?
Well, I've only been in one military prison, and I found it pretty grim, but then I'd never been in a prison of any sort before. And one chap that I had defended at a court-martial went to this North Hall, was sent to this North Allerton military prison, and I happened by chance to overhear part of a conversation he was having with his mates when he came out, and they were quizzing him about what it was like in the glass house. I remember he talked about everything being done at the double. Fair enough. The routine was pretty harsh, I gathered. He talked about pack drill. He also talked about the little refinements that the military police on the prison staff used to think up, like giving him a dirty old food tin to clean up to mirror finish. And it took a long time to reach their satisfaction with the finished effort. And then when it had all been done to their satisfaction, it was thrown out into a puddle to get rusty and to start again. Apart from that, I'm a bit vague about other memories, about punishment. Certainly after court-martial. As for the court martials themselves, there was a regular established procedure. The man charged was given the services of a defending officer. Sometimes the only bod who could be spared in the service, however junior and inexperienced he might be, he might find himself up against somebody with more on his shoulder as the prosecuting officer. Everything was laid out like a courtroom, as far as possible, as far as you can call it like a courtroom, with barrack room tables covered with army blankets. But it was laid out with, usually in a fairly biggish room, with the presiding officer and two other members of the court martial sitting at one end of the room. The prosecuting officer on one side of the room, and opposite him the defending officer, and then further down the room where the prisoner charged would stand with his escort. He would be marched in bareheaded. Escort would then be dismissed. The senior NCO who'd been in charge of the escort would remain within the courtroom. It was his job to act more or less as, in quotes, court usher, call in witnesses and see to any requests of the presiding officer. The charge would be read by the prosecuting officer, I think, not the president, and the prisoner would be asked whether he pleaded guilty or not guilty. The prosecuting officer would then read out the circumstances relating to the charge, and when he had finished, the defending officer would put up whatever he'd been able to figure out might stand the accused in good stead. Whether it was possible to lay out a complete answer to the charge, there wasn't much chance of wrong identification. It had been established already when he was remitted to trial by court-martial that he, not that he was guilty, but that everything pointed in that direction.
Was there much time given for the defence to get a defence together?
I seem to think in the one case that sticks in my mind, it was something like fortnight to 3 weeks. Because, of course, from the time that the man was remanded by the CO of the unit for trial by independent court-martial, it took some time for the staff captain of the brigade to lay on all the arrangements and to issue warning orders to the officers who would constitute the court. So sometimes it was more than enough. I have a feeling from my limited experience that it was probably going through the motions to try and lessen the sentence rather than be able to try and get the fellow dismissed. I don't think that would be a fair summing up in general, but within my experience, it was almost a plea in mitigation. I'm using legal terms and I'm not connected with the law at all. But anyway, after prosecution, after defending officer have had their say, the presiding officer might have his own questions to ask. It was then that the accused man had an opportunity, in addition to answering the presiding officer's questions, if any, I have a feeling that he was given the option of making a statement on oath, not on oath, or to say nothing. I think that's about right. Anyway, when all this had been heard, the court was cleared and the prisoner was marched out. When I say it was cleared, the prisoner had already been marched out under escort, and the defending officer, prosecuting officer, told to leave the court, which left the presiding officer and the other two. And if it had been a serious charge, probably a member of the Judge Advocate General's department, who, as far as I remember, his job would be to answer any legal niceties that the presiding officer might raise in question of suitable punishment, literally to fit the crime. To the best of my recollection, the two had to give their say to the presiding officer what they thought about the evidence they had given, what had already been said in the man's defence, and then to give their verdict of guilty or not guilty. And they, having had their say, then the presiding officer had his say. He expressed his thoughts, and if it was split between the other two, he obviously had the casting vote in a minor charge, which a sentence of detention for a limited period would be the answer, then there was no need for further legal advice. I can't recall one being remanded for a legal opinion. If it had been something dicey like that, then there would have been a judge advocate board present in any case. And the decision having been reached, the accused was marched in again. The escort stayed. And the finding of the court was then followed up by the sentence that had been decided. And I don't recall any time when the escort was dismissed and the accused was told he could go back to his own unit. My recollection is that he was marched off, out to whatever awaited him.
The judge advocates people, were they civilians or military?
Military. Well, civilians in uniform. But, again, most probably have been of a legal background, may even have been solicitors, but who had obviously had training in military law in addition.
Your feelings about the situation, you weren't a legal person yourself, but your feelings about courts martial, do you feel, even in retrospect, that they were fair?
Well, you asked me earlier about the time given for preparation of the defence. And I think I said it was more than adequate in many occasions. The accused had those three options. He could speak out for himself. And there were three officers on the court, constituting the court, who had in most instances never met each other, certainly hadn't met the accused. I don't remember ever being cowed by the presiding officer or browbeaten. It may have happened in some cases where it was a major lieutenant. Might have been a second lieutenant, but I think probably the lowest rank of the subsidiary officers would probably be a lieutenant. The senior major, most often the presiding officer, and within the strict limits of King's regulations. I think by and large it would be right to say that they were fair. I think, looking back, I think probably there were many who sat on court-martials who'd never seen the inside of a military prison, and I only did once, briefly. So that having got the process over, I don't think many would think, well, a week later, I wonder what the heck that pod's doing now or what's happening to him. I think nobody liked being on a court-martial very much. It was a different experience. But I think probably most, rather like myself, would be jolly glad when it was over. One got a little hardened to it by, on occasion, well, very often, company commander's orders. And certainly, if one had to be present at CO's orders, you know, which was a very formal procedure in any case, And the extra sort of heightened formality of a court-martial well, it made you want to get it over and be done with it. My impressions, anyway.
Where did you go from this situation?
You mean with the unit? Well, this overlapped when we were infantry and when we were armoured. I'm talking generally about the half dozen or so court martials that I seem to find myself on. I'm trying to think back to what we were talking about before this. It must have been the last days as infantry, I think. Anyway, November 41 was the time when we changed over. I think it might be the time to refer to a letter in this connection. I think it would be appropriate to quote a letter about the conversion from infantry to tanks. It was written from the War Office Annex, Hobart House, Grosvenor Place, SW1, by Lieutenant General Sir Ronald Adam. Adjutant General to the Forces. And it was addressed to our colonel, "My dear Heslop, dated the 21st of November, 41. I want you and all ranks under your command to know how sorry I am that the limitation in strength of the army and the needs of modern war have necessitated changing your role. The alternatives were to disband your battalion and raise a fresh unit or to convert you direct. There's no doubt about the correct answer. The conversion must be carried out rapidly, for we want units ready to fight in the spring. A battalion such as yours has the unit's spirit and organisation. I'm confident that all ranks will accept the change in the right spirit, will settle down to the new role, and become as efficient in it as I know you were as an infantry battalion. I know it's hard to sever your connection with one corps and join another, but you'll be very welcome in your new corps. All the very best of luck in your new role. R.F. Adam, Adjutant General of the Forces." That was addressed to Colonel E.T. Heslop, 15th Battalion, the Durham Light Infantry, Brookdale House, Uxbridge Lane, Stockton-on-Tees, County Durham. I find it interesting, looking at the Get That Now, that it doesn't in fact say what the conversion is. Obviously, there were moves leading up to this letter, which had made it obvious that we were to become an army tank battalion. I say army tank battalion, meaning to be equipped with infantry tanks, the heavy tanks, under direct army command rather than divisional or corps command. And Colonel Heslop's reply on the 25th of November 1941, "Dear General, your letter dated 21st November 41 is most welcome and helpful. The contents have been communicated to all ranks under my command. The battalion has, of course, made great strides since you saw us during our teething troubles on the beaches last year." That was when he was commanding, General Officer commanding Northern Command. "And we all felt fit and ready to take the field by the end of this collective training season. Our conversion," again it doesn't mention to what, "our conversion suddenly came as a shock, but the change has already been accepted in the right spirit. I see, in fact, every evidence of the will to make ourselves efficient for our new role in the shortest possible time. I can assure you we will all do our best, and we thank you for your letter of encouragement." Addressed to Lieutenant General Sir Ronald F. Adam, Baronet, KCB, DSO, OBE, Adjutant General to the Forces, etc., etc.
The conversion itself, was it hard to come out of a county regiment with county men in it into another entirely different role? How did the men take it?
Well, it was hard from this angle. Infantry battalion, round figures, 900 on establishment, something like that. Infantry tank battalion, round figures, 500. So there had to be a lot of sorting out. I was tempted to say weeding out, but I don't think that's fair. We all foregathered in company groups, either, I don't know what it was, deserted warehouse or something, in Stockton-on-Tees. And the colonel talked about the decision that we would be one of the first three infantry units to be converted and add to the strength of Royal Armoured Corps. He laid it on the line that there would be many who would not be able to go with us and who would have to be posted to other infantry units. He made a point that it was no reflection on any of the ones who were to be posted away. They would all realize, he said, that there were people within the regiment who were more mechanically minded. He wasn't talking about their fitness as soldiers, he was talking about particular aptitudes. And the question of the more intelligent members of the unit was left out of it, because that was to be decided while we were still at Stockton by a series of War Office, what did they call them, matrix tests. 11 plus plus, as a glorified intelligence test. And it weeded out some of the officers as well. I've said weeded out now. Quite a lot of them were obviously posted to other DLI units. Some of the officers who were not going to the Armoured Corps volunteered for the Indian Army. Charles Bowdrey, because he was a veteran of the First World War, when he got his MC, went to an infantry training centre. Second in command, Major Harwood, he stayed with us for a while. Yes, he did, because he was replaced eventually by Malcolm Dees, Major Dees, who was Royal Tank Regiment, and he joined us shortly after the official conversion, which didn't really happen until 1st of January 1942. I mean, things had started moving before then, but there'd been discussions about the regimental title. I think Daddy Heslop fought his corner that he'd accepted the change, but he wanted to see the Durham connection maintained in the title.
What title did he go for?
It was 155th Regiment Royal Armoured Corps, and in brackets following 15th Battalion DLI, but it wasn't. It was straightforward 15 DLI. I think at an earlier stage it had been mooted that it should be 155 RS, 155 Regiment, brackets 15 DLI, Royal Armoured Corps. But they thought 15 DLI followed by Royal Armoured Corps didn't fit, so That was put in brackets at the end. I got the job, a rather unenviable job, after we'd moved from the South Durham Stockton area to Hayden Bridge.
When was this?
Oh, I'll have to think about that and come back to you. But it was November or early December. I stand to be corrected on that. This letter of the 21st of November really set the seal on it. There'd been the CO and Second Command had been down to the War Office on more than one occasion in the lead up to this period. But of course, the results of the War Office intelligence test took some time to process. No computers, all to be done manually. For 900 BODs plus
this
officers.
Just a written test?
Yeah.
General knowledge? Or?
Yes, and, you know, if A equals B, write C, if not, mark D, or something like that. Some common sense questions. Where was I? Oh, going on to the BODs who are being sent away. Yeah, we went to Hayden Bridge in the late autumn, early winter of 41 to Hayden Bridge, which is in Northumberland. It's in the Tyne Valley just west of Hexham. We had, at that stage, still the four, the five, if you include headquarter company, we still had the four companies A, B, C, D. And A, B, D, and headquarters company were in Hayden Bridge, and C was detached further up the valley at Barden Mill. The regimental headquarters was in a requisitioned property called Threepwood, up the hill outside Allendale, outside Hayden Bridge on the Allendale Road. There we had the house and tarn huts, which were for the chaps in the grounds. They were different from the semicircular Nissen huts. They tended to look like a parabola, and they were, if I remember rightly, they were of cement sections. Not much more habitable than the average Nissen hut. Anyway, I'm rambling on. The BODs who went away, I was put in charge of a draft to go from Hayden Bridge to a DLI unit, and whether it was 6th, 8th or 9th, I don't know, but it must have been one of those in 151 Brigade, down to Ashford in Kent. I think there were somewhere between 30 and 50 BODs on that draft. And we left Hayden Bridge at 7 o'clock in the morning. And whether it was bombing that caused the diversions, I don't know. But we seemed to head down the west to Bristol and then back along the Thames Valley. The packed rations that we had long been consumed, and it was a devil of a job to find them. There were the odd trolleys on the odd stations where we stopped, and I forked out, and the chaps pooled what cash they had. There were some of them who were skint, and we managed to keep the wolf at bay. But it was nearly midnight when we got into Ashford. And the CO and his adjutant and his second in command were waiting. And they were very anxious to know just what they were getting. They knew that we were going to be on a much reduced establishment, and that of necessity we'd have to offload quite considerable numbers, and they wouldn't all be just the halt, maim, and the blind, and the thick, and the and the fellows who were always on CB or detention. But I tried to be as diplomatic as I could by pointing out that there had been this War Office test. I don't think I said intelligence test. Otherwise, they might have drawn their own conclusions about who they were getting. And talked about the necessities of people who were already able to drive, who were trainable as drivers as well as soft-skinned vehicles. Those who had an aptitude to be trained as gunners or wireless operators. That it was a very technical background that we'd had to look for, and certain aptitudes were necessary, and pointed out that we already had good words said about us as an infantry battalion, that we'd made our name as an infantry battalion, even in home forces, and that had led to us being selected for conversion. And I think I brought out the old bit about man management again, and before I got in too deep, I asked the colonel if I could be excused to go and see about getting the bodger meal.